Hello, and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guest is four-star General John Allen. Remember, we love taking your questions, so write into politicswarroom@gmail.com or send a tweet to @Politicon for next week's show. Now, we're going to get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. And please check out the links to our sponsors, Lomi, Miracle Made, and 3-Day Blinds in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting these sponsors. It really helps make this podcast happen. Please tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. James, the unlikeliest of heroes, Mike Johnson of Louisiana, Speaker of the House, defied the right-wing nutbag caucus, and the House overwhelmingly approved aid for Ukraine. Some are going to try to unseat Mike Johnson. I don't think that's going to happen, and we can wait. We'll talk to John Allen about what it means for Ukraine. But I tell you why they're not going to do what we might call a Kevin McCarthy on Johnson, deep six him. And a lot of reporting is really lousy. They talk about who the key Republicans are, Chip Roy or Jim Jordan or others. None of them matter. There is one person that matters that will assure that Mike Johnson is not unseated now, and that is Hakeem Jeffries. Hakeem Jeffries, it would be a motion to vacate the chair, which is what happened to McCarthy, and all it takes is a... the person in the chair needs a majority. If he loses 4 or 5 Republicans, Democrats vote against him, he'd be out. It won't happen. First of all, Jeffries, I think, trusts Johnson, even if he disapproves of most of his policies, far more than he ever trusted Kevin McCarthy. And secondly, you're not going to knock out a speaker for doing the right thing. So it's not a co-leader proposition in the House. But Hakeem Jeffries played this shrewdly. He is he's proven to be a very capable leader, and he's going to be Mike Johnson's guarantor that the nutbags won't get him, at least for now.
Well, I think American history is replete with people of not extraordinary backgrounds coming through in a clutch. I mean, Grant kind of comes to mind, but maybe more than anybody else, but Harry Truman certainly comes to mind. Peter Rodina, a lot of the civil rights movement by Fannie Lou Hamer comes to mind, of people that just gamed up. Excuse me?
I said Arthur Vandenberg, but go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay, Arthur Vandenberg, but whatever. We have people that are faced with a moment and somehow or another surprisingly meet the moment. I'm pretty sure what happened to Speaker Johnson is unlike the rank-and-file Republican, he was actually privy to the briefings. And I think he was smart enough, and I think at some level maybe patriotic enough. I've done videos on him. There's nothing I've said about the guy that I think is wrong. But he did step in to the moment and, got this thing done at the last moment. And for that, he should be recognized and should be praised. And I think he was more moved by the intel briefings that he got than anything else. But that's supposition on my part.
Well, no, from everything I read, I think that's right. And I think he does deserve enormous credit. I also think President Biden deserves enormous credit. He stuck with this. He didn't lash out when he might have had cause to. And you know, James, you mentioned the intelligence briefing. If I were to pick an MVP of this administration, it would be the CIA director, Bill Burns, whether it's over negotiated or apparently the enormously impressive briefings he holds back here. He doesn't seek much publicity, but he has certainly done a great job. And on the other side, if I wanted to pick the LVP, the least valuable player of this whole episode, it would be Marjorie Taylor Greene. Murdoch's own New York Post called her, and a great cover. I never thought I'd say it about the New York Post. Moscow Marjorie. She was handed a stinging defeat she deserved. And I would just note that someone who, as you know, I've followed closely for the last 5 years, Elise Stefanik, once again, never let principle get in the way of her ambition. She voted against aid to Ukraine, as did the majority of House Republicans.
keep your kitchen green and clean with Lomi.
You know, it helps in a lot of ways. First of all, it can compact a lot of trash, which I think is good. And the second thing, it helps because, you know, we, like a lot of people, we order too much. And we have waste. It's not a good thing. You know, I'm a big believer, although I don't follow it, it's a Jesuit philosophy called tonum quantum, as needed. Well, we don't do that. And, you know, if we're going to have a steak, you know, we'll have a 24-ounce steak and we'll eat 10 ounces of it or whatever. But I think this is just a terrific product. And I know it's useful in keeping a tidy kitchen. It's also useful in feeling like, well, maybe I went overboard, but, you know, we're going to reuse this. I think it's a great product.
It is a great product. And, you know, Earth Day was this week. So you want to do something for the planet by adding sustainable practices into your routine. Go Lomi. It can be hard, but Lomi makes it easy. Lomi is a simple climate solution for turning your organic waste into nutrient-rich Lomi earth that feeds our soil. Now, that's a big deal. Now, we were shocked to learn that landfill space is filling up fast. 35 million tons of food waste are added each year. 35 million tons. But when you add your home, you'll be joining us in making the change the planet needs. Now, we've invested in our Lomis. You know, it's revolutionized how we deal with food waste. Now, James, you and I have been around a long time, and we're convinced Lomi is the biggest kitchen innovation since the dishwasher. Maybe bigger. It's smart and a smart and simple solution to turn food scraps into plant food in just 4 hours. With Lomi, You'll transform almost anything you eat into a nutrient-rich, loamy earth with the push of a button. It cuts taking out the trash in half, eliminates bugs and odors in your kitchen. And if that's not enough, with loamy earth, you get to feed your lawn and garden with an all-natural fertilizer that you created out of your food scraps. It's the perfect tool to upgrade your yard. Just jumpstart your spring planting and grow nutritious food. Our lawns look better than ever, and I don't miss those extra walks out to the trash cans with heavy food waste. And now, Lomi's new app lets you track your environmental impact, earn points, and redeem them for freebies from Lomi and other great brands. Now, you deserve to get rewarded for doing good. You need a Lomi in your home. Whether you want to start making a positive environmental impact or just grow a beautiful garden, Lomi is perfect for you. Head to Lomi.com/warroom and use the promo code warroom to get $50 off your Lomi. That's $50 off when you head to Lomi.com/warroom and use promo code warroom at checkout. Thank you, Lomi, for sponsoring this episode. You also can find the link in our show notes. Guest is retired Marine four-star General John Allen, who has held command posts all over the world. Leon Panetta, one of the true wise men in American public life, called General Allen an outstanding leader, a brilliant strategist, an exemplary Marine, end quote. It's good to have you back, General. So let's start with what Congress did after a disgraceful delay. They passed a $61 billion aid package for Ukraine, thanks to the House Speaker, Mike Johnson. What was lost in that long delay? And I assume we can get the weapons quickly there from supplies in Germany. And what difference do you think it's going
to
make?
Well, first, it is great to be back on with you, Al, and to see James. And I wish I was with him in Denmark or Paris or wherever he is this moment.
Me too.
several things, I think. The front generally held. It's about 1,000 kilometers, the line of contact between the Russians and the Ukrainians. And while the Russians were pushing pretty hard in several spots, it generally held. The approval of this $61 billion didn't come a moment too soon. And you will see relatively soon, I believe, the leading elements of this support be on the ground and in the hands of the Ukrainians, who will put it to work pretty quickly. And this will give them the ability, I think, to stabilize the line, the front, and to blunt or maybe even roll back some of the Russian penetrations. The Russians, Putin, has been salivating over this kind of a development. You know, the great strategic objective of his, in order to facilitate his operational level and tactical objectives, has been to try to stymie the capacity of American leadership of the coalition that is supporting the Ukrainians. Because once that occurs, time is no longer on the side of the Ukrainians. Europeans haven't been able to come together with enough support to offset the absence of American support. So with the approval of this package and its rapid movement into the hands of the Ukrainians, it restores, I think, Ukrainian sense that they can blunt the Russians, maintain the stability of the front. But very importantly, it sends a very powerful message to Putin that he's not calling the shots in Washington anymore.
Yeah, it sure does. It, as you say, can stem any Russian advances they were planning. We read a major summer offensive. That will be much harder now. Can the Ukrainians, they were on the offensive a year and a half ago. It didn't quite work out as well as they had hoped. But with this new ammunition, drones, aircraft, weapons, missiles, is it plausible Kiev could regain the offensive actually and push the Russians out of some of that territory?
Well, I think there's always going to be limited battles. I use battles as a quantitative term to indicate small action. There'll be limited battles along the line of contact for some period of time. Now, you made an important point, Alan. That is, a year and a half ago, the Ukrainians put in a pretty substantial push with the idea of moving towards ultimately, pushing the Russians completely off of the 20% of Ukraine that they hold and moving actually to the coast of the Sea of Azov. Everyone massively overinflated their expectations for this offensive. They didn't have the combat power then to push as far as everyone had hoped or had been encouraged to expect. They don't have the combat power today. This is going to be a long struggle. It's going to be a long fight. And the capacity for the Ukrainians to make limited gains over a period of multiple offensives is going to be how they'll do this. There isn't going to be one great push that collapses the front and we have this Russian collapse along the entire front. It's just not going to happen. They don't have the combat power. We've not given them the support that they need to do that. They really needed assault breaching capabilities to penetrate the very extensive and quite in-depth Russian complex obstacles. We didn't give them that kind of breaching capabilities. And so they were going up against those obstacles with suboptimized forces, and they paid a price for it, frankly. So we didn't get the expected outcome, but I think our expectations were way overinflated. So, Al, I think in the future, these kinds of limited offensives are going to have to be the way the Ukrainians do this. Hold in areas they can and achieve their limited objectives cumulatively over time to have the kinds of effects that they want to, which is to put themselves in a position where the Russians will have a very serious conversation with them about what peace might look like.
Well, I want to pick up on that. I'm an avid reader, Atlantic. I love Anne Applebaum. She's been great on this. But Elliot Cohen wrote an interesting piece a couple of weeks ago in which he noting this was almost like a World War I grinded out killing fields and wondered what is Ukraine's real theory of victory. The Russians have that terrible system, that terrible dictator. They're willing to throw people into those killing fields. They don't seem to get as much backlash as you'd hope for at home. At least we don't know about it. So what's the theory of what might be called victory for Ukraine down the road, General?
Well, there is the stated theory, and then there is potentially what will become the reality as time goes on. The stated theory is that they'll recover all of the lost territory of Ukraine as we have known it, plus Crimea. And that's just not realistic, frankly. And I love the Ukrainians. I support in every possible way their being able to stabilize the line and eventually ejecting the Russians. But we just have to be realistic that they don't have the combat power now to do that. And so to stabilize the line, achieve what they possibly can given the resources that they have, not give up any substantial territorial gain to the Russians over a period of time. And I think that's going to give us the capacity with this new multi-billion dollar, as I said, $61 billion infusion of equipment and capabilities to perhaps get us in a position in 2024 where conversations can begin to occur on some form of a ceasefire or an armistice of some kind or another. You know, I want the Ukrainians to be successful. I want them to get the Crimea back, but we have to be realistic about what they can accomplish. And I think very importantly, the West has to be very realistic itself and not push the Ukrainians into military actions where they are just not going to be successful.
This is also, as you know so well, as well as a military issue, it is a political issue. And I'm just talking about the politics here. You always enjoyed a great bipartisan support on Capitol Hill. That was a different Republican Party. The majority of House Republicans aid to Ukraine, the majority. The Republican Senator J.D. Vance of Ohio, it's a waste of time. We can't manufacture enough weapons that Ukraine needs. Leading House Republican chairs, Mike Turner and Mike McCall, Intelligence and Foreign Affairs, say some of their colleagues are buying into Russian propaganda. What are the implications if there's a side pro-Putin element in one of our major parties?
Well, I think the answer to that is we have to deal with the realities that we face, and many of them are not dealing with the realities that we face. You know, the larger issue, of course, is that if you go back and you track what Putin has done in the period of time immediately following the fall of the Berlin Wall and the end of the so-called Cold War, he has either by force of arms changed the borders of multiple countries in the region or interfered directly militarily in the internal affairs of countries in that region. So the idea that in some form or another, the Ukrainian conflict is of no value to us, that the Ukrainian conflict is irrelevant to American national interests, is just wrong. It needs to be reconsidered in every possible way. And it's very clear that there's an important and persistent and pervasive push by the Russians to sow the information sphere with doubt about whether the Ukrainians can, in fact, ever win, about doubt as to whether this conflict is in the interests of the United States or more broadly the interests of U.S. leadership of Europe and the EU and NATO, and doubt about whether Ukraine is a legitimate political entity and deserves its independence from the historic imperial Russia. And all of that is coming at us in the information space. And some people who are very poorly informed on international affairs and international relations are buying into it. They're buying into this inherent perspective by Vladimir Putin that Ukraine doesn't have a legitimate reason to exist outside of the Russian sphere of control and Russian sphere of influence. And that's just not true. And why would we believe that after so many borders have been changed by force of Russian arms with the depredations that have inevitably accompanied the application of Russian force, the things that have been done to the Ukrainian population, the slaughter and the systematic rape of the Ukrainian population, why would we believe that that would end with the defeat of Ukraine? Moldova is next. Georgia is next. And at some point in the future, should he believe he has sufficient support by the Chinese, we could see him becoming, quite bold on the issue of the eastern flank of NATO. So his track record is very clear, Al and James. His track record is very clear. It's his intent to control all of the near abroad around Russia. Ukraine is in his sights right now. Moldova is next. Georgia is next. We should expect that this will not be the end. And for America to believe that this conflict is irrelevant and somehow exists in isolation for how the Chinese potentially view Taiwan in the future is simply wrongheaded. It is simply uninformed and a misinformed view but it is the constant drumbeat of Russian disinformation that this campaign and this war has no relevance to American leadership and ultimately to Europe.
So, General, I'm trying to come to grips with this, and let's talk about movies to South China Sea, and let's talk about the United States Marine Corps. The immediate past commandant, as I understand it, made some pretty significant changes to the stated mission of the Marine Corps. And if you could walk through, like, when you were first commissioned in the Marine Corps that you saw and felt and loved and served, how is it different for a young guy graduating on the set and next one on the plane was at Quantico and OCS? What's the different Marine Corps you faced with, and what's the different Marine Corps this young person is?
Well, it's a really important question. And for those of us who grew up in one environment, we now see a very different environment for the Corps. For me, for virtually all of my career on active duty, the Marine Corps was the nation's combined arms force and readiness. We were a force of combined arms to include really substantial ground forces, complemented by very capable aviation components, supported with an extremely capable expeditionary logistics capability. We were both tied to the Navy for our strategic mobility and tied to the Air Force for rapid strategic airlift to get to a spot where we needed to be very quickly. And that capacity wasn't intended, James, for us to take on the Soviets head on in the European theater. It just wasn't. You know, as a young officer, I did multiple tours with the 6th Fleet in the Mediterranean because we needed to have the capacity to dominate the southern portion of the European front. But I also did a tour in Norway, which was the northern flank of the NATO front, where again, maritime forces, of which the Marine Corps is part, played an important role. So we had a flank mission during the height of the Cold War, but very importantly, for all of the other combatant commanders around the world, in the event of an emergency in Africa, or in South America, or in Central America, or in Southeast Asia, in the event of an emergency, the Marines were there. And we were there pretty quickly. And we got there pretty quickly because we could move by sea. The shipping was there. The amphibious shipping was there for us to move quickly. Or we could move by air. And so the combatant commanders that ultimately held responsibility for operations plans and contingency response around the world knew that the very first organization they could call on with that would come with substantial fighting power, combat power, was the United States Marine Corps. So today, the Marine Corps has been remissioned to operate in the island chains of the Western Pacific against the Chinese. You know, during the height of the Cold War, we were never missioned. We were never configured to fight the Soviets head on. We just weren't. Because we had to be light, we had to move, we had to be a combined arms team to deliver a lot of firepower very early in a contingency. Today, that's different. And we've had a number of contingencies that have emerged around the world where the Marine Corps couldn't show up, didn't get there. And so now what's happening is we're relying on our special operators to accomplish some of these missions that have been traditionally the mission of the Marine Corps. So I worry. I'm not going to criticize the previous commandant, but I worry that the nature of our Corps, which was an expeditionary combined arms force and readiness, also known as the nation's 911 force, has been reconfigured ultimately with a very specific mission in the Western Pacific to oppose the potential for Chinese aggression. And it just inherently limits the value of the Marine Corps to a national command authority and to our combatant commanders around the world.
Well, I have a pretty good understanding. I understand what you're saying. I've read a lot about this, but and this is just sort of corporal and amateur, whatever, but it looks like the South China Sea is a place that we better be equipped for bad things to happen. And that's, I don't know, it strikes me as maybe not a bad strategic direction, because I don't know if we're very good in Afghanistan, Iraq, or Vietnam, or all of the other places we've gotten bogged down in. I don't know, maybe it's just me, but I think we're better, you know, moving fast and been breaking things, as they say in the Silicon Valley.
Well, you know, you called yourself a corporal a minute ago. You were personally involved in breaking things, probably. Yeah, that's what the Marine Corps does very well. Right. And we can break things, but now we're not going to be able to break things everywhere around the world, which was really important to this country.
Right.
And we could still have broken things in the South China Sea. I mean, there's an entire lift component of amphibious ships that are going to need to be produced in order to move this new force. And those ships aren't even on the drawing board. So, you know, my concern is that, and this was an explicit investment strategy, that we would divest to invest. So we got rid of a lot of Marine Corps capability that you and I grew up with that doesn't exist in the Marine Corps anymore. We have no tanks in the Marine Corps anymore. And we have fewer, you know, Amtraks, the armored, lightly armored amphibious personnel carrier. We have fewer individual tube artillery pieces, and we've reduced our aviation. Not because we just did it arbitrarily, but because the Commandant's plan was to divest these capabilities early to be able to invest in future capabilities. And one of the most important of the future capabilities is the lift necessary to get us into the fight. And that capability is still some time off. And so I worry about this capability gap that we have right now in terms of the nation's capacity for contingency response.
Well, before I turn to Al, Marine Corps people, no matter what your words, it was different then, it was better back then. And right before the pandemic, my wife and I were near Parris Island, and we went on up to Commanding General's out of town to get the regimental commander, gave us a tour. And I got to tell you, these Marines today are trained three times better than we were. When I looked at what they went through and what their training regime is, I mean, my view of just spending 4 hours at Parris Island is we're capable of cranking out some pretty well-trained people. Is that your observation?
And I want to be very clear about what I have been saying over the last few minutes. I have not in any way insinuated that the Marine that you were and I am and they are is any less a Marine that we put them across in Iwo Jima. You know, these kids are hard as nails. And frankly, to me, they're the next greatest generation. And they're going to try to accomplish whatever mission we give them, because they're as good today as they've ever been. And they're probably going to be even better in the future. So we don't have a deficit of quality or a deficit in capability of the United States Marine today. The question becomes, have we made all the right strategic decisions on the nature of the Corps so it best fulfills our inherent responsibility to be the nation's expeditionary force in readiness?
Yeah, we train people to do the mission they're assigned to. They don't make the mission, but I just wanted to make the point before I turn it out.
You made an important point.
The training that these youngsters are getting is, to me, compared to the training that I got, is pretty damn good.
And very good.
I gotta tell you.
It is, as we say in the Corps, as you would remember, these young Marines are as hard as woodpecker lips.
There you go. And by the way, the women are not trained. I don't think trained any less than the males are.
Jeez,
they train pretty hard, too.
Not at least. All Marines, hard as woodpecker lips.
All right.
This is an awful difficult transition for me, General, but I want to point out that among your many, many achievements, was it about a decade ago, you drafted for President Obama the architecture for any possible Israeli-Palestinian accord. You know, as we get further from that, do we get further from that possibility? Is it even more remote with the October 7 Hamas terrorism attack and massive Israeli response? Or as some smart observers like the New York Times suggest, maybe this could provide an opening?
Well, we have an opening, I think. The question is, does this moment create an opening in the context of a larger commitment to a two-state outcome versus, to your question, whether the reality of achieving that moment is possible? And I think those are two different things. This administration, as did the Obama administration, and I was really honored, frankly, and this is, this is not a advertisement. I was really honored to have the opportunity twice, once as a serving officer, the three-star deputy at CENTCOM, and then later working directly for John Kerry, twice to spend months and months in the Middle East and in the West Bank working to engineer this two-state outcome. But the reality is severalfold. Turns out that Beebe was never committed to supporting the U.S. objective of a two-state outcome. And the problem with that was that while we had, in some respects, a verbal commitment to support America's effort to work with the Israelis and the Palestinians to create this two-state outcome, the reality was that they were never committed to it. And one of the most difficult aspects of this, Al, while we all want it, and while we all, I think, intellectually understand the necessity for it, and just make a point here, the necessity of a two-state outcome, I think, goes directly to the long-term strategic viability of the Jewish democracy. The long-term viability of Israel is tied, in my mind, irrevocably to a legitimate two-state outcome. And I will never fall away from that. Because the Jewish democracy, Israel, living next to a sovereign, independent, non-hostile Palestinian state is the only way both of those people can go forward together. Now, the reality, of course, is that on the West Bank, the illegal Jewish settler communities that have put roots down all over the West Bank, and when you consider the presence of the increased construction of the separation walls, it makes it very difficult to envisage a contiguous Palestinian state on the West Bank. And even during the height of our work, you talked about the architecture that we built. Even during the height of that work, we did not consider the Gaza Strip at that particular moment, because for all intents and purposes, it was a Hamas dominated black box. We couldn't see into it. It was impervious to our efforts to work with the Palestinians and the Israelis for some kind of an outcome. So it was really off the table. But on the West Bank, we went a very far distance down the road towards having a viable security plan that could then support the political and diplomatic resolution of what are known as the final status issues that would give the Israelis and the Palestinians, with American support and international support to a lesser extent, give us all the confidence that this was a possibility. I think it's going to be a very distant possibility going forward. The Palestinian Authority has been stomped on very hard since the 7th of October on the West Bank. And when people talk about what will a post-conflict security environment look like in Gaza, there are folks who very quickly point to the likelihood that the Palestinian Authority will pick that up. Well, they never wanted to pick it up to begin with. Remember, Hamas is a very different outfit than the PLO was on the West Bank. You'll recall when Hamas was elected democratically to lead the West Bank, they took the PLO leadership to the top of the highest building in Gaza and threw them off. So there was no love lost between the two, and the idea that the Palestinian Authority elements on the West Bank could somehow now reinvigorate a Palestinian security entity for the control of the West Bank or of Gaza Strip, on top of which then would become some form of a post-conflict Palestinian political outcome, is very hard for me to see. The other piece of this is that that Hamas exists within a resistance narrative. Hamas and Hezbollah are resistance entities to the existence of Israel. And if we think that somehow, as a result of this campaign in Gaza, that resistance narrative has been diminished one whit, we need to reconsider that consideration. Because I think that now with the casualties and the destruction, the sense of anti-Semitism that has tragically exploded around the world. We're suffering through it right now in the United States, another wave of it. If we think that that resistance narrative has been reduced one bit as a result of this campaign, and whether this campaign will eliminate Hamas and the Al-Qassam brigades as a physical threat to Israel, we just need to reconsider those assumptions. Sorry to go on so long.
Oh, it's a depressing but very realistic thought. Let me just try. Your expertise is so pervasive. Let me try one more, James, and turn it back to you. Overlooked with the crises in Ukraine and Gaza, and biggest and most powerful country in the world, we have a national election. There will be a lot of rhetoric on China. What would you hope we would be addressing? What do you fear we could be addressing that might cause more problems?
Well, China is really fundamentally different in so many ways in just the last few years because of now Xi Jinping in a third term. You know, when Hu Jintao was the president and premier, and before him Jiang Zemin and others, you know, they would serve maybe two terms. The sense of collective Chinese leadership was largely understandable. It was deliberate. It was something with which the United States could find the capacity to have a dialogue. We've now seen that Xi Jinping has accumulated more power unto himself than any other Chinese leader except Mao Zedong, and perhaps even more because Mao Zedong never had a nuclear arsenal, which, by the way, they're expanding dramatically. And we've also seen a shrinkage in the system of government that the Chinese have traditionally benefited from. Instead of having a collective leadership, which was what the Soviet system was as well, replaced now by Vladimir Putin, and the Chinese system of leadership, which was a collective leadership, we now have solitary leadership in both of those countries, with Xi clearly dominating the decision-making. But he's also got a lot of problems in China that are really significant for him to have to deal with now. Some very significant demographic problems, some economic issues he has to face, his capacity to expand Chinese influence using the Belt and Road Initiative has been certainly less than he had anticipated. And the United States, both in the Trump administration before that, but the Trump administration in particular and the Biden administration, have held the Chinese to account on trade issues. So I think that, look, my personal view is that we must find a way in the 21st century for the United States and China to be fellow travelers in this century. But we have to be realistic about where our values are and where the Chinese values are and how we can find a way to coordinate, perhaps cooperate with the Chinese, but hold them accountable for those dimensions of trade imbalance, for their violation of human rights, the change that we have seen in the democracy of Hong Kong, the potential threat to Taiwan. Hold them accountable for that and not stray from our values going forward. And yes, there will be a lot of rhetoric, there always is in these campaigns, that will attempt to vilify the Chinese. And the one thing that I think I know a little bit about is that when relations between states are founded and largely defined by confrontation, the distance from confrontation to conflict is a very short, very slippery slope. And I do know personally that when you draw first blood, walking back from that moment for two great states, when blood has been drawn, and James talked about the South China Sea, that perhaps is one of the most unstable situations where our two great countries could see first blood be drawn. Stepping back from that moment will be very difficult. So we've got to manage the rhetoric. And while we should hold the Chinese accountable for trade imbalances and IP theft and how they may ultimately use AI, not for good, but to our detriment, we also have to recognize they're not going anywhere. And we're going to have to find a way, as we did with the Soviets during the worst part of the Cold War, where we could talk with them and have a means of coexistence. I think we need to have the willingness to talk to the Chinese going forward. Hold them accountable, but be able to talk with them going forward and not let the really vitriolic conversation about the Chinese blot out the potential for us to still have a conversation with them.
So, General, you're a highly, educated, trained, thoughtful general officer. And I go through my career and, boy, we thought we did something in Israel in the late 90s with Ehud Barak and, and he and Clinton had, and then you came and tried to, you know, roughly it's all going to end up, if it ever stops, in the same place. I was in Colombia. We won a Nobel Prize, you know, to resolve the conflict with the FARC. Of course, we did no such thing. It's still raging down there. I've worked in Afghanistan and, you know, Lee, after Fredericksburg, said, it is good that war is so terrible, or we would grow to love it so much. Try to put into context the human attraction for war. What keeps dragging us? When we think we escape, we get dragged back into this shit, and it's everywhere in the world now. And what is that? What is it that draws human beings to this god-awful thing?
Well, that may be the question of the century.
Okay, that's right. Well, you're the general of the century.
I'm going to give you my thoughts, and that is... Diplomacy is hard. Diplomacy is always hard. Because for diplomacy to be successful, one or both sides needs to be willing to accept risk and be willing to and to be vulnerable in the face of a potential opponent or maybe even an enemy. And so for many countries in the world, or for many of the antagonists that propose to be leaders of countries, rather than be willing to assume some level of risk, rather than to be willing to politically taint themselves by trusting an opponent or an enemy, they go to the first, next, easiest solution in so many of these cases, which is the employment of security forces to oppress the population and the employment of military forces to secure their borders or to conduct aggressive wars. So in many respects, it's often easier to employ security or military forces than it is to engage in the much harder process of constructive diplomacy, where powers, multiple states, or bilateral engagements can find a way to move forward, developing trust, accept that there will be a vulnerability in the process of this trust, and not have the military solution being the first button pushed in relations between states. And I think that's one of the problems. You know, the United States sat at the top of a global system, which for many, many years emphasized diplomacy. But as we have begun to withdraw in our presence around the world, as our own diplomacy has suffered, we've seen the rise of strongmen. They're always strongmen. We've seen the rise of strongmen. We have seen authoritarian states gather more power. And when they do, and they are unconstrained and not held to account, what they'll do frequently is to employ that force which is best suited to accomplishing their objectives, which is security forces and military forces. And I think, James, that's exactly the reason that we're seeing this now. The world order, which ultimately eschewed the idea of the use of military force as the first option in the intercourse of states in the world, that system has begun to break down. And it makes it much easier now for states to use military force on each other or on their people and not be held to account for it.
Well, that's a very satisfactory and thoughtful answer, as I thought it would be. And would, General, just a point, I'm coming in Europe and I've been reading about World War One. I'm reading the whole, you know, the sleepwalking into it. And, you know, most of our history, we had really big and bad, evil people. We had Stalin, we had Hitler, we had Tojo. And what struck me as I started thinking about this, none of these people were particularly bad people. I mean, they had bald head, they were kind of antiquated and monarchs. But Franz Joseph wasn't, you know, in the realm of horrible people, Lazar was not horrible. The Kaiser was worse than most, but I don't think he'd be on anybody's top 10 list. The British, Wilson was a... And we just lapsed into this goddamn thing. I mean, I understand how we got into World War II, but I just, what scares me is untalented people with less than stellar talent have a default position of war, which I think buttresses exactly what you said. It's the easy solution. Let's just go haul off and have Verdun and kill a million fucking people. That's a great idea.
Well, there were, I'm trying to remember the name of the battle now. I'm having a senior moment here, but
so many. I'll try not to think of myself.
Yeah. Well, World War One, of course, killed at least 20 million people.
Right.
You know, when everyone sat down to celebrate Christmas in December of 1913, when everyone sat down to celebrate Christmas in December of 1913, they would not have imagined that 4 years later, less than 4 years later, Europe would be in shambles and 20 million people would be dead. Right. To your point. And I think that because war in that period of time was an alternative to diplomacy, and because national honor had to be fulfilled and ultimately be secured by the strength of arms rather than the softness of diplomacy, that was the first resort of that sequence of events that the Guns of August so well portrayed. And we've got to be very careful about sleepwalking into another crisis like this, with the consequences, of course, are much higher with nuclear arsenals involved here.
Well, thank you so much, General. I just can't tell you how illuminating this conversation was. I know our listeners will, and I always love talking to you. A great Marine, a great American.
My honor.
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much.
Make every night a miracle with Miracle Made Sheets. I can tell the difference in the sleep I get when I got it at home and I'm on the road and I don't have it. It does make a difference, I promise you. And what you want to do is throw everything you can at this sleep deprivation or whatever, insomnia, whatever they call it.
No, that's absolutely right, because sleeping at the right temperature is one of the most important ways to feel rested the next day. You know, we used to struggle with sleeping too hot, but we found a way to sleep in perfect comfort all night long using NASA-inspired silver-infused bed sheets by Miracle Made. Their self-cleaning, antibacterial, eco-friendly bedding prevents 99.7% of bacteria and requires three times less laundry because they stay fresher three times longer. You'll stop sleeping on bacteria that clog your pores and cause breakouts and acne. So sleep clean with Miracle. And trust us, with no more gross odors, life is a whole lot easier on your spouse. That's because they use temperature-regulating silver-infused fabrics inspired by NASA for maximum comfort. Imagine getting better sleep every night. Even better, Miracle sheets are luxuriously comfortable without the high price tag of other luxury brands. They feel as nice or even nicer than bed sheets used by some five-star hotels. You'll feel like you're on vacation every time you get in bed. So go to trymiracle.com/warroom to try Miracle-Made sheets today. And whether you're buying them for yourself or a gift for a loved one, if you order today, you can save over 40%. And if you use our promo, warroom, at checkout, you'll get three free towels and save an extra 20%. Now, Miracle is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 30-day money-back guarantee. So if you're not 100% satisfied, you'll get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiracle.com/warroom and use the code WARROOM to claim your free three-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/warroom. To treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode. And you also can find the link in our show notes. All right, now for the outrage. Senate Republicans plan to win back the majority by picking rich guys who can spend a lot of money with no experience or baggage. In Wisconsin, it's a wealthy banking executive, Eric Hovde, business and rhetorical record, including his assertion when his bank owned a senior assisted living facility that, quote, almost nobody in a nursing home is a point to vote, end quote. After all, he noted, they only have 5 to 6 months to live. His bank is a co-defendant in an elder abuse wrongful death case. You know, James, you and I could have a field day with this, but I have someone better to criticize that assertion as deeply offensive and wrong. At the top of that list would be Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, the great basketball player who started his pro career in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and is one of America's more thoughtful citizens. Talking about Mr. Hovde's comment, he says, quote, what's troubling here is his desire to take away the rights of people who have spent a lifetime contributing to this country based on a physical attribute, age. Hubert Humphrey said one of the moral tests of our society is how we treat people in the twilight of their lives. Candidate Hovde has flunked that test.
Wow. Good point. Excellent point. And, you know, they got this guy there. They got the guy in Pennsylvania, McCormick. Of course, it turns out he didn't anything like what he was trying to tell people he was. The same thing with this guy that got out, Sheehy, in Montana. But a lot of their prize recruits have turned out to not be able to hit a curveball, to say the least. But
yeah, she's story changes.
I don't know what
day,
he shot himself or somebody shot him. It came. Looked like if you got shot, you would remember who shot you.
And where it happened.
Yeah, it's kind of a life-altering event to get shot. But I'll let Mr. Sheehy dig himself out of that hole. I don't have I'm in Paris, and I get the New York Times, the international edition. And there's some people in life that you know that they're good people, and you get to know them and read them, and they're even better than you thought. Very few. You know, I would put our mutual friend Mark Guerin in there. A guy I want to really pay tribute to is Nicholas Kristof. And they printed an international edition. I don't know how many words this was. I don't have the actual Times hard copy, but I can't believe they would give anybody that much space. But he made some, I can't tell you I agree with all of it, but he made some really, really, I thought, pertinent observations about the U.S. and President Biden and what's going on in Gaza. It's this stuff, if you look at what's happening on these campuses, I don't think this shit's going away. I think this is a really difficult, intractable problem that's frankly not going very well right now. But I would recommend that anybody read Nick's piece because I think it was written talently. He's a talented writer, and I think he had some critical things to say that we need to consider.
Yeah, I agree. I think they ran a huge block in the paper.
Boy, it was freaking. It's one of the longest pieces I've seen, and it's like 2 pages. I mean, you know, and if they did, I give the Times to people. A lot of credit because I think Nick said some things that people need to hear and need to consider as we go forward in this. Get your room right with 3 Day Blind. Well, you know something, Al? If I'm here in Paris, if you go to the Louvre or the Museum d'Orsay, you go to it's all about light, okay? Everything in art, photography, and life is about light. My wife has taught me that. And when you can control this most fundamental thing to human mood or the way you feel, and the technology and the brilliance to be able to control this remotely, to be able to have the light adjust you. Maybe you like dark at night, maybe you like 30% light during the day, whatever it is, you're in control of one of the great things in the world. You're in control of light. And boy, let me tell you, sitting in the light is everything. The light is everything.
Yeah, it is. You know, for most of my life, blinds would always let light in at the crack of dawn. I don't much like it. My wife hates it. It's a rude awakening. And if you left them open, getting out of bed to close them is a real pain. So you wonder, why aren't my blinds smart and automated? Luckily, we discovered there's a better way to buy blinds and window treatments. It's called 3 Day Blinds. They are the leading manufacturer of custom window treatments in the United States. Now they're running a deal. Buy one and get one 50% off. Now we can shop for almost anything at home. So shop for blinds at home too. 3 Day Blinds, local professionally trained design consultants, average 10 plus years of experience, of providing expert guidance on the right blinds for you, all in the comfort of your home. Just set up an appointment and you'll get a free, no obligation, quote, the same day. We love that the expert team at 3-Day Blinds handles all the heavy lifting. They design, measure, and install for you so you can sit back, relax, and leave it to the pros. Once we heard about them, we knew it was time to upgrade. Their blinds come in tons of great styles, so it's an easy sell on the family. With 3-Day Blinds, you'll be excited to be getting better sleep and opening and closing blinds from the comfort of your beds. Alexa, I slept great. Now let there be light. We know you'll like 3-Day Blinds as much as we all do. Go ahead and pick from thousands of options made for any budget or style. Plus, after 45 years in the business, they're the highest rated blinds company on Trustpilot. It's a perfect spring project, especially because they do all the work. Transfer your home with 3-Day Blinds today. And right now, you can get a 3-Day Blinds buy one, get one 50% off deal on custom blinds, shades, shutters, and drapery for a free, no charge, no obligation consultation. Just head to 3dayblinds.com/war room. That's buy one, get one 50% off when you head to 3dayblinds.com/war room. One last time. That's the number 3daiblinds.com/war room. You also can find the link in our show notes. All right, now, James, for our listener questions. You know, we really do have a thing for our listeners. They are so good. They are so smart. They're so challenging. Jim in Stockton, New Jersey, wants to ask you, how do political strategists, consultants look at the margin of error in a poll? Having a 3% margin of error can make a world of difference in how you interpret the results.
Well, let me get a little arcane here, because a question a lot of people have. So when you say that the error factor, the margin of error, is plus or minus 3, understand that encompasses 6. But what the kind of Stan Greenbergs or Peter Hartz or Bob Teeter or any of these guys would tell you, the probability that it falls plus or minus 1 is actually substantially better than it falls plus or minus 3. So, and different polls have different methodologies. Some are better, some are better taken, some tend to be. But what I find is that you aggregate it. You know, one of the better things that's happened to me in modern campaign coverage is poll aggregation. We used to do it in 92, but we did it on our own. But I think these are more the trend lines over a period of time where you aggregate a bunch of polls. And, you know, I could tell you, you can go to Nate Silvan, which one's the most accurate, but sometimes this year's poll is not as accurate as last year's poll, not as accurate as next year's poll. I can't tell you, but I have found one of the more, I don't say annoying, one of the great misconceptions is polling has become not very good. I don't know if the polling is any better or worse today than it was at the turn of the century, to be honest with you. I think they've more or less been pretty instructive. They can't get it down to a half a percentage point, but they get pretty close. And they were not, by the way, they were not wrong in 2022. People just didn't read them. I think the problem is not that people read too many polls. They don't read enough polls, don't pay enough attention to them. But that's a contrarian view.
You're right. They underestimated Biden's vote margin by a little bit in 2020, but got it basically right. And they're actually right. I mean, Hillary did win in any event, I agree. Al in Atlanta.
Right, expectations can't be precision, right. But it's got to be,
right,
you know, around the thing. And I think the polling industry is overly trash, but no one ever did any good by defending the institution of polling. We're supposed to take offense at it. I never took any offense at it. I thought it were valuable.
All right, we'll show courage. We'll show courage and go there. Al in Atlanta, Georgia. I'm going to answer Al's question. why don't the Democrats portray Leonard Leo as the big George Soros out to be? First of all, let me give a little bit of a defense of George Soros. You may not like some of the people he contributes to. He's done an awful lot of good. I mean, he did an awful lot of good in trying to, you know, further democracy in Eastern Europe. He got attacked for that. That's the reason that awful dictator Viktor Orban hates him so much. So Lenin, I think, is more he advocates mean policies, and he funds them, and he funds them tremendously. And I think Democrats probably could do a better job of talking about the role that Leonard Leo. If Trump is elected, Leonard Leo has the total charge to pick all the judges, basically any judge he wants. That's a pretty big deal, and I think Democrats probably ought to talk about it more.
Well, I definitely think they should. He also has $1.6 billion. He also controls the Supreme Court. I mean, come on, let's look at what it, you know. My favorite is Justice Alito went on a fishing trip in Alaska. It was just this extra seat on the G5. What the hell you want me to do? You know,
it was a shocker. There was an extra seat.
Yeah, I was just at Dulles Airport. I was hanging out, and then somebody says, "Hey, damn man, we got an extra seat here. Why don't you jump on?" They're all so fucking corrupt. And of course, he's at the head of the entire corruption of the entire deal. And I don't know when people are going to be able to wake up to the massive corruption that exists. I think most day in and day out federal district judges, I think by and large, there are different parties, and for 90% of them are hardworking people. Probably a little less true at the appellate court level. It's totally true at the Supreme Court level. And that this guy has this inordinate power. And what's going to happen, and we want to get Catherine Stewart on the show, because if Trump wins, which is a distinct possibility, all right, he will turn over the Justice Department and the federal judiciary to Leonard Leo. And that will mean but one thing, that this whole Christian nationalist, crazy-ass, right-wing, goofy, not grounded in theology, nutty view will take over the United States government, and we are closer to being a theocracy than anybody can ever imagine. And you cannot warn people enough.
Yep, I
you know, go read Church Militant.
Right. Tanya, I think I got the, yeah, Tanya, in Carlsbad, California, says, regarding the Comstock Act, we love the Comstock Act, don't we? If it can be used to halt the sale of mifepristone by mail, also be used to stop the sales of erectile dysfunction products, wouldn't that be the end of it? James, pretty good question from Carlsbad.
Well, first of all, Carlsbad is where the North Gate to Camp Pendleton is. So I know Carlsbad well. It's in, I think it's the northernmost outpost of San Diego County. But a good question, and you come from a good part of the world.
You have an answer?
I don't think they're going to go after erectile dysfunction, okay? Maybe they would.
You don't think Leo would do that?
I wouldn't put it past them. But, no. I don't think that a lot of these 60-year-old judges are very big into getting rid of Viagra. I'm just going to go out on a limb on that.
I think that's a good point. The next question is from Bill in Houston, Texas. I'm going to Houston, Texas this week to see my dear friend, Bill Kimball, who I have been friends with for 70 years. So this is not the same Bill, but he asks, James, suppose the race is, this is to me, I guess, is close in September, and Trump insists that RFK Jr. be included in the debates. How should Biden respond? First of all, I think it's unlikely there's going to be a debate. But in any event, you know, we go back and forth on RFK. James, I think more likely he may be hurting Trump more than Biden. There's some evidence of that. I'm still more of the he hurts Biden more. What we need to find out is what happens. If he's at 10% now, you know, will he be at 5% in October, and where will that 5% come from? But Bill, I don't think there's going to be a debate, and I don't think RFK is going to be in it.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I tend to think that he may hurt Trump more than Biden, but I don't have any, you know, my reasoning is thus, and I think the weird, because he's a very weird guy, and the way to the Democrats should run is just make him into crazy and weird, because I'll give you my view. There's a pool of voters, and I cannot tell you what percent they are. I know it's more than 2%, probably less than 20, but there's a lot of range that are just of the fuck the whole thing mentality. God damn it, I hate everything. And Biden's not going to get any of that vote. All right? If you just hate the world, if you're an incel, if you hate Taylor Swift, and you hate the entire world, I think that RFK's looniness is actually attractive to you in some way. But I don't have I think that we think, because we're really old, that the Kennedy name holds some magical sway. I mean, shit, 2/3 of Democrats don't know what Kennedy was. I mean, it was hard for us to comprehend that, but they're like irrelevant. And what good did the Kennedy name do Joe Kennedy in Massachusetts in a Democratic primary? So do I say that I know this? I'm very confident of it. I'm not. But I think the craziness is the more attractive thing to him.
I think that. I think it's the FU vote that, he appeals to. And they're not going to. Right. And they're probably bigger than we
They're out there be. Somewhere.
James John in Chicago, Illinois. Said you predicted that President Biden, you haven't predicted, you've said he's not getting the support from black voters that he needs. Do you think, I guess you can address that, but conversely, will Trump lose some of the single issue voters that he needs to win back the presidency? John, I'm not quite sure which single issue voters you're talking about, but I think he's more likely to lose the small band of Haley voters. But James, you take that.
This is the question that I really wish someone would ask me, and he put it in very good terms. Biden is not going to replicate his 2020 coalition, which was 17% share of under 30, and he got 62% of the under 30 vote. The black share was 12, and he got 90%, maybe 90% in change of the black vote. He's not going to replicate that, I don't think. He's doing much worse than that now. I suspect it's a reasonable belief to believe that some of that will come back. But what's really happening is he's overperforming in over 65, and he's probably going to overperform with white voters. So the coalitions, they change over a period of time. And some of the coalitions that we saw in 2008 going forward turned out to be not exactly prescient. And I think the question is right on the money. And I'm skeptical that the president can replicate his 2020 coalition in numbers with under 30 and black. But I do think he seems to be on track to do better with over 65. And seems to be on track to do better with white voters. But I would caution everybody. We have a big, the party does. And I think it's Trump has this vulnerability that the question is, if you go after something, what do you go after, Trump or the Republican Party? And I don't think it's that easy a choice. I think there's something to be said for because the Republican brand doesn't really stand for anything anymore. And I think we have a golden opportunity here to really do significant damage to the Republican brand. But I have to tell you, you've been reading a lot of polls over a long period of time. And one of the things that's happened that's disturbing is Democrats would have a 5-point advantage on party ID, self-described. Now, the Democrats didn't vote as orthodoxly as Republicans did. That has dissipated. It's now 50-50. And I think the Democrats have to not just go after Trump, but have to go after the whole Republican brand.
Wally in Calistoga, California, says Truman turned his campaign from "I'm just mild about Harry." "I'm just wild about Harry." To "give him hell, Harry." Hit the rails, building voter enthusiasm. Attack do nothing Congress. Going back into session, Maine made 238 stops. Dewey made 40. How does Biden pivot to generate that kind of enthusiasm? First of all, Wally, I got to tell you, Joe Biden's not going to make 238 stops. He just doesn't. This is not in him. And the way he is going to generate enthusiasm is one way. Go Donald Trump and return to the chaos of yesteryear.
Yes. He ain't going to make 23.8 stops. And we go back to conversation we've had on this show. I've had it as a client. As an asset, what he can do, he's always been kind of, you know, he's unlimited in terms of his humanity, his empathy, I think his wisdom, his experience. But what he is not is a great candidate. He never has been. He's not good on the attack. You know, he just isn't. So they just have to work around it. But they're not going to be able to do the whistle-stop train to it. They're not going to be able to turn this around. You know, they can do some things better, but there's a limit as to what they can accomplish. By the way, Trump is not that great at that either. So let's understand what we face with. We face with, do you want to continue what you have today or do you want to go back to what you had 4 years ago? It's pretty clear that we want to continue what we have today, but this is not going to be an inspirational campaign at all.
John in Sonoma, California, last question says, is Trump the same for white evangelical Christians? Obviously, he's guilty, but are they going to be with him to the end?
Well, I've seen a lot of pushback on what exactly is a white evangelical Christian. And it seems to me to predict what is happening is these self-described, whatever, I don't think they practice Christianity, but that's a person's own. Trump might be the most unchristian person I've ever known. He's clearly, I've had a pretty good Catholic education. He is the most un-Catholic human being that you could imagine in everything that's in the magisterium of the church. But I think, and we talked about doing this, and I hope we're able to do it, but the institutional church attendance, everything is going down around the country. And what's left is completely, I think, anti-Christian, but that's just where we are. And I think there's a real crisis in all across Christianity today. And, you know, like everything else, Trump exposed a lot of rot in America.
Yeah. And if you want to really find out about what motivates the evangelical Christians, read Tim Alberna's book. He was a guest on this program. He grew up in an evangelical family. He's written, and it's a really, really, really good book. Keep those questions coming. If we didn't get to yours this week, we'll try to get to it next week. We really appreciate them. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. Don't forget to send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Now, following this episode, we'd appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, Lomi, Miracle Made, and 3-Day Blinds in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting them because when you do, it helps make this podcast happen. Now, to keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. You also can find other shows you might enjoy on the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast site. Now, remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.